Thanks for joining us, Gabe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Where are you right now? You're in Santa Fe?
I'm in Santa Fe, New Mexico, yeah.
When you're not writing poetry, what are you doing in Santa Fe?
Well, my day job, as it were, is I work for St. John's College. I'm the director of communications there, which means I kind of oversee the marketing and the promotion of the college. So I do everything from, you know, write the press releases to events and kind of just promote it, you know, in any way possible. So distributing news and that sort of thing.
You were here in El Paso a couple of weeks ago reading from your new book, The Seed Bank. You mentioned, I think, that you had a radio show. Is that true?
Yeah, actually, I have a long history with radio. I've had several shows.
You got a great voice. I'll tell you that right now.
Oh, thanks. I've been practicing. No, it was music, live music shows. It kind of began as an idea that I had to host. I'm a music journalist. I also write. And at the time, I was a columnist here for a weekly alternative newspaper called the Santa Fe Reporter. I had a column there. And they invited me to come on the air a couple times, and I pitched a show and about, you know, just live music, you know, play music in bands. And so they said, yeah, sure, come on, you know, let's see how it works. So I did that. It was called The Junk Drawer, and I did that in studio for 3 years. And then we took it on the road, as it were, to a couple of places. Here there was a microbrewery here, Second Street Brewery, and this other really wonderful restaurant called El Farol. And so I did it for about 3 years, which was great, but it was incredibly time-consuming.
Yeah, tell us about it.
it was a lot.
Yeah.
And then, you know, here and there, having some shows, I'm really into music. I actually got into writing through music. It's a longer story, but yeah, it's one of the many things that I kind of keep myself busy. That's a great thing about Santa Fe. It's a small town, and if you have, you know, a lot of interests, it's, you know, you can kind of exercise those.
Do you listen to music while you're writing poetry?
Not too much. I feel that at this point in my life, approaching 40, I need to concentrate as much as I can on the page, and that really requires a closed, locked room with you know, very little natural lighting, and just kind of really, you know, really similar to a bar, I would say.
Wow.
But not quite.
Do you like working in the dark?
You know, I got to tell you, I do. With the lights turned off and the curtains drawn, very early in the morning, as you know, the sort of the daybreak comes along, that's really the sort of ideal time for me.
Can you talk about why, or that's just the way it is? No, I'm serious.
It's really for me. I find it. I'm most lucid at that point. I found that if I write at the end of the day, everything that's happened in that day informs the writing in some way. And I think, obviously, you know,
bad days?
we all have bad days, and we all have really great days, right? But the point is that I think being able to have that moment of just repose and being able to make sense out of it as, you know, really start, and on my own terms, because I don't have control of that at the end of the day, because there's so many things in my head, you know, where I'm exhausted. Whereas in the morning, I have the ability to make sense of it, to make some kind of, okay, this is, you know, say, for instance, I'm working on a specific line or whatever. It's really an issue of control. And it only lasts for maybe, what, 2 or 3 hours tops. So.
Right. Robert Olin Butler has this book called From Where Dreams Come, I believe the title is. It's a very popular book on craft. And he says the reason why he writes first thing in the morning, before he looks at emails, before he listens to radio, before he even talks to his wife, is because language is fresh, and there's no separation between the language of the dream, which is rhythmic and imagistic, and the language that you're using in your poetry or fiction. Whereas at the end of the day, you've been using language all day in deceitful ways, and that has an effect on it.
That was an interesting thing to say, Daniel.
I didn't say it. I'm quoting. Perfect. So I understand that, but why the darkness? Why not natural light? I mean, I know I also write in the mornings, and I know Ben writes in the mornings. A lot of writers I know write in the mornings, but we love natural light.
Sure. Well, aside from being a vampire, I'm kidding. No, but I'm so easily distracted. The thing about it is, and here's where I've kind of boiled it down to it. I'm making, within those 2 or 3 hours, that little window of time each morning, I'm making decisions of what to include, of how to make sense. So it's everything is very sort of lockstep in a way. And anything that can distract me from that is an issue. So if I can control anything, I'll control the environment, I'll control, you know, the temperature or whatever else. But again, it's really is maybe these control issues, I'm not sure. But it's really just a sense of I want to make the decision and I want to make it on the terms that I need to make them on. Whether the poem is telling me to do this, whether it's I'm just kind of putting it aside. Maybe it's a piece of language, it's a piece of text I remember. Even if I just sit there and think for 2 hours, it's an opportunity for me just to, again, just to really sort of play off of that. And you know, my poetry, I depend a lot on the page. I see it in a lot of ways as a canvas. I see it in a sort of very painterly way. So it's very much a composition in looking at, well, what color and what balance and what shape and how is it going to look on that page? And so there's a lot of things going on. And so the light, I mean, it's funny enough. It's just something that I can internalize myself a little more. I can center myself a little more. The most important thing, I think, is really slowing myself down a little more.
Do you write on a computer?
I do. and that's really it. And it becomes really this intimate space. And again, it's just, you know, your painters depend on the light, the sort of, and the hues, photographers, the same thing. And for me, it kind of, it's almost the same thing in the sense of I need to know that it's, you know, I need to know that it's morning. And you could say to yourself, well, I can create this sort of artificial environment in that it's any time of day, but I always know it's morning, you know, because my mind is sort of functioning in that way.
Right.
So.
Right. I'm the opposite. I really need to know. I have to be in touch with whatever the physical landscape is outside that comes inside. I need that. I really do. And if I'm writing a long time, I literally have to step outside for 10 minutes and then come back in.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I write in my office and at home, and I have these French doors, and they go out into the balcony. I face those French doors, and right outside is the SM Mart in Juarez. I can see the parking lot and the little white buses going back and forth.
Oh, sure.
But that I feel it connects me. Now, let's segue to your poetry. You were, Gabe, you were the second, I believe, recipient of the Andrés Montoya Prize in Poetry. That must have been a big deal for you as a poet, to your very first book to win such a prestigious prize. Can you tell us about that?
You know, it was a pretty tremendous thing. Of course, Cheryl Luna, who I have tremendous respect for.
A graduate from our MFA in creative writing.
She was the first winner. And, you know, it was a really interesting thing that happened with that first book. I was living in New Orleans, and this was 2005 of August, and I had submitted a chapbook to Francisco Aragon, who I know worked a little, and this was kind of on a lark. I know that he had worked with St. Mary's College on a few projects in California where I did my master's work, and, you know, I was familiar with the prize, and I guess it was a year before I sent him a manuscript of, like, what do you think about these poems? And at this point, you know, I had completed my MFA. I was teaching at a university, and I was really in this place where I didn't know what my poetry was. You know, was it this sort of, I was really interested in, you know, these sort of grand ideas of language and some other things. And then I was just really remembering my love of language and why I started doing it in the first place. So anyway, the point was, is I sent it out. So I didn't hear anything for a long time. Again, this was sort of kind of a cold, blind call type thing. And then Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. And
you were there.
I was there, and actually my wife and I, we lost our house because of it. So in the middle of this, we were at a relative's home outside of Dallas, outside of Abilene, when I get this email from Maria Melendez saying, hey, I just noticed, you know, you're from New Orleans. I hope you and your family are okay. This really lovely email. By the way, we got your manuscript, and we'd like to publish it. We want to know if you're interested.
You're talking about Maria Melendez, the Chicano poet.
Yes, indeed. And I'm like, you've got to be, this was 4 days after Katrina. So I'm like, I'm homeless at this point, quite literally.
Wow.
And then I get this email. So I'm like, you got to be kidding me. And so, of course, I said, well, thanks for the email. Of course, you know, as you know, you just got to, these opportunities are few and far between. And so we ended up in Santa Fe. You know, my wife and I actually came to college up here. And so we knew we had some friends here. And it was a very curious time and, you know, very, very dark period in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But we ended up here, and I was offered an emergency residency from from the Santa Fe Art Institute, and I told him, I said, you know, I'm from New Orleans, but you know, I've got this book contract, and I need to finish it. I don't want to lose the opportunity. So they gave me a place to stay for 3 months. My wife went back to Louisiana to stay with relatives while I finished this book. And in the meantime, I found out about the prize, the poetry prize, the Andres Montoya, and they said, you know, if you feel that you have a book here, you know, you should maybe submit to it, apply to it. And so I did. You know, I worked and I wrote some what I consider some really site specific pieces, namely The Outer Bands, a long poem in the back of the book.
That's the name of the book, The Outer Bands.
The Outer Bands, correct. And I was back in New Orleans in I guess it was 2006 when I got the call from Valerie Martinez, another really wonderful poet who judged the prize that year, saying that I'd won.
Awesome.
And it was a tremendous time.
Jeez,
you know?
So through all that destruction and sadness and darkness, there came
a book.
There came a book.
That's awesome. That's
there
awesome.
Came a book, and it was on top of that to win that prize was just a tremendous thing, and still is. I mean, I'm still very, very proud of it.
How did you wind up in Santa Fe after that?
You know, we decided to stay. We settled all our affairs. We actually bought another house. I still have my teaching gig, and you know, we really wanted to be a part of the rebuilding. But as you could imagine, just being there, it's a very emotional thing, and to see the devastation on that level. And we decided, my wife and I decided, you know what, maybe we should just go somewhere else. And I think we had that opportunity to do that. We had the resources and the wherewithal, and after you experience something like that, you're kind of bulletproof, you know. You have this, you can do anything at that point, right? And so we decided to move on, and so we decided either Austin, Chicago, or Santa Fe, and we decided on Santa Fe.
I remember shortly after the tragedy in New Orleans, there were a lot of very well-intentioned but bad poems about Katrina.
Oh, yeah.
And if anybody has the authority, legitimacy of writing a poem about it, it's certainly you. Did you write any poems about it?
I did. The long poem, really. Well, the book, The Outer Bands, is really what I did was, well, I think the question was really, let me start there, was, you know, how can you make art through this or with this? It's a question I really internalized during my residency at the Art Institute, in that, you know, am I just trying to make sense out of this, or am I trying to make a statement out of this, or am I trying to make art with this? So what I did was I decided just to, there were 28 days essentially between Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita, and I took the headlines from the New York Times and put them as a header essentially, and then as a kind of a proof of life type thing, like here's the date and here's the headline, and then I wrote essentially what was happening that day. And this took me, again, I was in Chicago, I was in Texas, I was in New Mexico, in all of these different places and different mind frames, and I just decided to really write an almost correspondence of it. So I didn't know if it was going to be, you know, this kind of epic verse or whatever it was, but I knew that I just wanted to be as true to the experience as possible. And what had happened was, what was interesting about that, it was a really liberating experience on my aesthetic of writing poetry, in the sense of it really liberated me from saying, you know, all the theories and stuff that I learned in grad school that I had sort of followed with and really tinkered with for a lot of years. I put those aside and said, you know, this is what I really sort of listened to what the poem was trying to essentially say. Mm-hmm. But I'm thankful for it at the end of the day for all of the bad part of it. I think ultimately it was a good thing.
There's this idea that when somebody dies, immediately they may not know that they're dead, and so they cling to the very closest living person and kind of think that they're them. I had this character one time in a novel who didn't have any duende when he wrote, and so he used to hang out at sites of tragedies where a lot of people died and try to write poetry, hoping that the spirits would enter them and take over his language. And this is just kind of a way of suggesting that all that death and all those spirits running around in New Orleans could have had a very profound effect on the spirit of your book, and that's not a bad thing.
No, not at all. And I think that, you know, when I return, when I go home now, you know, it took a lot of years. I mean, I think it still does, too. When we fly in or when we drive into the city, it's still very much there, these old scars and stuff. But it's been really interesting on the response of, and the truly the resilience. I remember teaching after the hurricane, going back to the university and teaching, and you know, my students, it would be a room full of students, quite literally, in one of my literature courses, and you know, oh yeah, I'm in a FEMA trailer and stuff. We've been there for, you know, a few months now, but you know, just these kids were just as tough as nails, you know, and that really put things in perspective to, you know, if you remember me. So it's just really the kind of, again, that sort of the outward experience of what the media portrays and the thing that is, the daily thing that is. And so that was, you know, all of it really cut into me in a way.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you are a media guy, right?
Yeah.
And you've done, you know, typical things, reporting on news, et cetera, et cetera. What is the relationship between poetry and news?
Nobody's asked me that before, but I'm glad you did, because I'll say this, very little.
That's it. Wow. Okay.
And the thing, I mean, the thing about it is, once again, it's, I'm interested in art made of found objects. You know, I'm interested in collage. I'm interested in pastiche. I'm interested in that non sequitur, that those tiny bits of language that one remembers. I'm obsessed with memory and how it works. And I think, at the end of the day, all of these ideas are fighting for real estate. I consider myself a minimalist poet in a way that I really chip away at the words that are there, in the sense of every line that I leave in it, every piece that I decide belongs there, is really a hard won fight. And in a way, in a lot of the media stuff, that's kind of almost the same thing that I do on a very sort of practical, pragmatic level. That is just a fight for that real estate. It's you're trying to tell this thing. What is the best angle in which I could do that? So a lot of them sort of, there's problem solving happening in marketing,
right.
Whereas I call it making art in my poetry mind, right? So to me, you know, there's not a lot, which is probably why I don't get a lot of free, you know, writing gigs anymore. You know, because, you know, I tend to go off on these tangents or whatever. But and at the same time, a lot of the pieces that I write begin with that question: what am I trying to get out of here? In this new series of poems that I'm writing, a lot of it's based in El Paso.
You're from El Paso.
I'm from El Paso, born and raised El Paso High. Woohoo! and I've always had a really strange relationship with El Paso. It's always been, I think, a strained relationship, yeah. For some reason, and I really don't understand why. Because I think it's a lovely place. My parents are still live there, and other family, and I spent quite a bit of time there. But I've always, the poems that I've always started in El Paso never end there, right? I always go away, and so I think, you know, that's part of it. That's the new question that I'm asking. So anyway, the point is that I don't see. I'm just sort of retelling the news in a more obscure way, I guess.
Let's talk a little bit about your new book, The Seed Bank. It just came out, and this is your second book of poems. What's different about this book?
Well, I think if you look at the composition of the outer bands, my first collection, it has remnants of my master's thesis, and there are some poems that may have been included in there. Some poems that I was emotionally attached to because they had been the first things that I ever published in mm-hmm. journals and things. Of course, the Outer Bands with, you know, that series of poems. In a lot of ways, it's different. The Seed Bank is very much, in a way, my first book, I guess, if that makes sense. I and it was funny because I was trying to make sense to it myself. You know, when that turn happened for me after the book. When I reached a place where I thought to myself, this is a voice in which I really want to embrace. It's literally for my first book, because it was such a cacophony of sources. This is a book where I sat down and I said, this is what I want to address.
So in your aesthetic, you seem to be something of a minimalist. Who are your poetic heroes?
Well, if you consider Dwight Twombly a poetic hero, Alexander Calder, a poetic hero, John Cage, and then there you go.
There you go.
Quite literally. I mean, it's my influences are really from the visual. I mean, Wallace Stevens is probably, you know, Michael Palmer, Wallace Stevens, Lynn Ginian. So, I hang out there a little bit.
You hang out there.
But I really yield towards more of the visual minimalists. And so again, I'm obsessed with the page in a lot of ways.
Is there a struggle in you to write, on the one hand, a meaning-based poetry and then a poetry that challenges a meaning-based poetry?
Well, one of the things that a never-ending question that I have is language, and how is language reliable in what I'm trying to, is it a reliable tool in what I'm trying to say?
The answer is yes and no.
Precisely. And the thing is, and it's an open-ended question in that I look very deeply at the mechanics of language. I'm interested in sort of the beginnings of language as someone who's bilingual, especially growing up in El Paso. I'm interested in where this idea of meaning both in English and Spanish meet, in a way. I've tried to write in Spanish. I did another interview recently, and they asked me if I wrote in Spanish. And I said, you know what, even though Spanish was my first language, I find it really unnatural, in a way, to write in Spanish, probably for my inability. And there's a considerable amount of distance in my skill set in actually being able to write in Spanish. But the point is that it's a question that's always there. In the question of meaning, of what I'm trying to do with these poems, it's really trying to answer of, am I capturing this correctly? And the word, and you could define the word correctly in a number of ways. But at the same time, with this new book, with the Seed Bank, I think I had something to say. And I wanted it to be maybe interpreted in a kind of way, in a certain way, not to sort of provide in a sort of an expository sort of position, but certainly one of, this poem is about this. And you can take it in a number of ways, but ultimately I want to address the fact that what do you do after loss? Where do you pick up, and what are the things that you use to start over? And that's really one of the motivations that I had. And a lot of it, again, it's with this, not to dismiss this set of poems, but the new book is really a big part of it. The question is, well, you got to go home. And home for me was increasingly, you know, El Paso, and not running away from it, or not actually making art from this thing.
I have to mention that your book is put out by Mouthfeel Press.
Yes.
And Mouthfeel Press is started a couple of years ago by Maria Maloney, who was a graduate from our MFA program. And it started off very small. She was doing chat books and an anthology of El Paso writers. But now she's part of the distributions, part of the consortium. And tell us about the experience of going with Mouthfeel Press.
My first experience with the University of Notre Dame Press was really wonderful in a lot of ways. I mean, it was as ideal as you can get. Working with Francisco and Letras Latinas was, I think, a real gift for somebody like me who was really, frankly, green in the literary field. I'd written for years. I'd been, you know, through two creative writing programs. But the actual industry end of poetry was brand new to me. So I feel very lucky to have been helped and continue to be helped out by you know, Francisco and Maria and others. But with this book, my mind was different. My mind frame around this book was very different, and I wanted to find an independent press that would sort of take it where it needed to be, you know, taken. But I think I wanted I wanted to be a part of the process. I wanted to be a part of the conversation, a part of the editorial, because that part of it intrigued me. And, and in Maria and in Mouthfeel, I found a very welcoming home. You know, Maria, I found to be a very astute reader, and to be quite honest with you, you know, she understood what I was trying to do. And that was a blessing, quite frankly. And El Paso, you know, I don't want to sell that short. That, you know, it's a hometown press. I think she produces wonderful books.
She's doing a good job with it.
Yeah,
every press has to start somewhere, and she started it, and she's doing well. And I think having your second book is a gift for Mouthfeel, just as much as I'm sure it is a gift for you to be published by them.
Thank you for saying that. But I think it's great, and I think she. The treatment, the book, and certainly the finished product, and I think it's been just as great as an experience. And you know, part of it is, you know, I grew up listening to punk rock, man, and so you know that indie sort of, you know, do it yourself sort of thing. You know, I'll be 40 next year, and part of that, I want to remind myself that you know, I write poetry because I don't want to be part of the flock. You know what I mean? I write poetry to put a stamp on things. You know what I mean? And so, and I think she understood that.
We're talking to Gabriel Gomez here on Words on a Wire. And Gabriel, we always ask our guests who are poets to read a poem because we have a segment called Poem of the Week. Could you read us a poem for this week's segment of Poem of the Week?
Sure, I would love to. I will read a poem called Clovis Culture, and this is from the Seed Bank. And a little explanation, one of my former students at the University of New Orleans, she and her husband they train racehorses. And so we were having a conversation one day during office hours, I think, about the names of racehorses, like how those funny names, you know, come about. And so she kind of explained to me how it's, you know, blood lineage and all kinds of different things and how little bits of the language are broken in to sort of fit in. So what might seem like a really, you know, silly name if you know, just look on these on some of these web pages for these, you know, for racehorses, whatever, it's actually a very complicated system which tells everything about not only of the value of the horse, but really the animal's history. And I found that just to be absolutely fascinating. And so I wrote a poem about it. And anyway, this is Clovis Culture. My friend explained the reasoning behind naming racehorses. Bits of broken dialogue, tongues of sire and dams effused through blood or breeding. More anthropology than etymology. Think for a moment of the horse's ambient body as code or cursory history, the animal's map. In illo tempore, the spirit succumbs, pit fires cloud the floodplain momentarily, ash, movement, more ash. Syllables veer from the burning, from conjecture, from the dominant voice. The horses, imagine, gallop blindly in unison, until they hobble, their hooves impress the groomed earth, scoop fistfuls of clumped dirt aloft and onto the track, when they pass.
That was Gabriel Gomez reading from his new book, The Seed Bank, put out by Mouthfill Press in 2012.
Gabe, thanks for being on Words on a Wire.
Thanks very much for having me.